but Fawcett's mother appears to have been at the center of the machinations. In a letter years later to Conan Doyle, Fawcett implied that his mother had been a silly old thing and an ugly old thing for being so hateful to Nina, and that she had a good deal to make up for. At the time, though, Fawcett's fury was unleashed not at his mother, but at Nina. He wrote her a letter saying, "You are not the pure young girl I thought you to be." He then terminated their engagement. For years, they had no more contact. Fawcett remained at the fort, where, high on the cliffs, he could see a pillar dedicated to a Dutch maiden who, in 1687, had leaped to her death after her fiancé deserted her. Nina, meanwhile, returned to Great Britain. "It took me a long time to recover from this blow," she later told a reporter, though concealing the true reason for Fawcett's decision. Eventually, she met a captain in the army named Herbert Christie Pritchard, who was either unaware of the charge against her or unwilling to cast her out. In the summer of 1897, the two wed. But 5 months later, he collapsed from a cerebral embolism. As Nina put it, "Destiny cruelly struck me again for the second time." Moments before he died, Pritchard reputedly told her, "Go and marry Fawcett. He is the real man for you." By then, Fawcett had discovered his family's deception and, according to one relative, wrote to Nina and begged her to take him back. "I thought I had no love left for him," Nina confessed. "I thought that he had killed the passion I had for him with his brutish behavior." But when they met again, she could not bring herself to rebuff him. "We looked at each other, and invincibly this time, happiness jumped all over us. We had found each other again." On January 31, 1901, 9 days after Queen Victoria died, ending a reign that lasted almost 64 years, Nina Patterson and Percy Harrison Fawcett were finally married and eventually settled at the military garrison in Ceylon. In May 1903, their first child, Jack, was born. He looked like his father, only with his mother's fairer skin and finer features. "A particularly beautiful boy," Fawcett wrote. Jack seemed preternaturally gifted, at least to his parents. "He ran about at 7 months old and talked freely at a year old," Fawcett boasted. "He was and is, physically and intellectually, far ahead." Although Ceylon had become for his wife and son an earthly paradise, Fawcett began to chafe at the confines of Victorian society. He was too much of a loner, too ambitious and headstrong, audacious to the point of rashness, as one observer put it, too intellectually curious to fit within the officer corps. While his wife had dispelled some of his moodiness, he remained, as he put it, a lone wolf, determined to seek paths of my own rather than take the well-trodden ways. These paths led him to one of the most unconventional figures to emerge in the Victorian era, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, or as she was usually called, Madame Blavatsky. For a moment during the late 19th century, Blavatsky, who claimed to be psychic, seemed on the threshold of founding a lasting religious movement. Marion Mead, one of her most dispassionate biographers, wrote that during her lifetime, people across the globe furiously debated whether she was a genius, a consummate fraud, or simply a lunatic. By that time, an excellent case could have been made for any of the three. Born in Russia in 1831, Blavatsky was short and fat, with bulging eyes and folds of skin falling from her multiple chins. Her face was so broad that some people suspected she was a man. She professed to be a virgin. In fact, she had two husbands and an illegitimate son, and an apostle of asceticism. She smoked up to 200 cigarettes a day and swore like a soldier. Mead wrote, "She weighed more than other people, ate more, smoked more, swore more, and visualized heaven and earth in terms that dwarfed any previous conception." The poet William Butler Yeats, who fell under her spell, described her as the most human person alive. As she traveled to America and Europe in the 1870s and 1880s, she gathered followers who were mesmerized by her odd charms and gothic appetites, and, what's more, by her powers to seemingly levitate objects and speak with the dead. The rise of science in the 19th century had had a paradoxical effect. While it undermined faith in Christianity and the literal word of the Bible, it also created an enormous void for someone to explain the mysteries of the universe that lay beyond microbes and evolution and capitalist greed. George Bernard Shaw wrote that perhaps never before had so many people been addicted to table rapping, materialization seances, clairvoyance, palmistry, crystal gazing, and the like. The new powers of science to harness invisible forces often made these beliefs seem more credible, not less. If phonographs could capture human voices, and if telegraphs could send messages from one continent to the other, then why couldn't science eventually peel back the other world? In 1882, some of England's most distinguished scientists formed the Society for Psychical Research. Members soon included a prime minister and Nobel Prize laureates, as well as Alfred Tennyson, Sigmund Freud, and Alfred Russel Wallace, who, along with Darwin, developed the theory of evolution. Conan Doyle, who in Sherlock Holmes had created the embodiment of the rationalist mind, spent years trying to confirm the existence of fairies and sprites. I suppose I am Sherlock Holmes, if anybody is, and I say that the case for spiritualism is absolutely proved, Conan Doyle once declared. While Madame Blavatsky continued to practice the arts of a medium, she gradually turned her attention to more ambitious psychic frontiers. Claiming that she was a conduit for a brotherhood of reincarnated Tibetan Mahatmas, she tried to give birth to a new religion called Theosophy, or Wisdom of the Gods. It drew heavily on occult teachings and Eastern religions, particularly Buddhism, and for many Westerners it came to represent a kind of counterculture, replete with vegetarianism. As the historian Janet Oppenheim noted in The Other World, for those who wanted to rebel dramatically against the constraints of the Victorian ethos, however they perceived that elusive entity, the flavor of heresy must have been particularly alluring when concocted by so unabashed an outsider as H.P. Blavatsky. Some theosophists, taking their heresy even further, became Buddhists and aligned themselves with religious leaders in India and Ceylon, who opposed colonial rule. Among these theosophists was Fawcett's older brother, Edward, to whom Percy had always looked up. A hulking mountain climber who wore a gold monocle, Edward, who had been a child prodigy and published an epic poem at the age of 13, helped Blavatsky research and write her 1893 magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine. In 1890, he traveled to Ceylon, where Percy was stationed, to take the Punsil, or five precepts of Buddhism, which includes vows not to kill, drink liquor, or commit adultery. An Indian newspaper carried an account of the ceremony under the headline, Conversion of an Englishman to Buddhism. The ceremony commenced at about 8:30 p.m. in the Sanctum Sanctorum of the Buddhist Hall, where the high priest Sumangala examined the candidate. Satisfied with the views of Mr. Fawcett, the high priest said that it gave him the greatest pleasure to introduce Mr. Fawcett, an educated Englishman. Mr. Fawcett then stood up and begged the high priest to give him the Punsil. The high priest assented, and the Punsil was given, Mr. Fawcett repeating it after the high priest. At the last line of the five precepts, the English Buddhist was cheered vociferously by his co-religionists present. On another occasion, according to family members, Percy Fawcett, apparently inspired by his brother, took the Punsil as well, an act that, for a colonial military officer who was supposed to be suppressing Buddhists and promoting Christianity on the island, was more seditious. In The Victorians, the British novelist and historian A.N. Wilson noted, "At the very time in history when the white races were imposing imperialism on Egypt and Asia, there is something gloriously subversive about those Westerners who succumb to the wisdom of the East, in however garbled or preposterous a form." Other scholars point out that 19th and early 20th century Europeans, even the most benignly motivated, exoticized the East, which only helped to legitimize imperialism. At least in Fawcett's mind, what he had been taught his whole life about the superiority of Western civilization clashed with what he experienced beyond its shores. "I transgressed again and again the awful laws of traditional behavior, but in doing so learned a great deal," he said. Over the years, his attempt to reconcile these opposing forces, to balance his moral absolutism, and cultural relativism would force him into bizarre contradictions and greater heresies. Now, though, the tension merely fueled his fascination with explorers like Richard Francis Burton and David Livingstone, who had been esteemed by Victorian society, even worshipped by it, and yet were able to live outside it. Fawcett devoured accounts of their adventures in the penny presses, which were being churned out by new steam-powered printing machines. In 1853, Burton, disguised as a Muslim pilgrim, had managed to sneak into Mecca. 4 years later, in the race to find the source of the Nile, John Speke had gone nearly blind from an infection and almost deaf from stabbing a beetle that was boring into his ear canal. In the late 1860s, the missionary David Livingstone, also searching for the Nile's source, vanished into the heart of Africa, and in January 1871, Henry Morton Stanley set out to find him, vowing, "No living man shall stop me. Only death can prevent me." Incredibly, 10 months later, Stanley succeeded, famously greeting him, "Dr. Livingstone, I presume?" Livingstone, intent on continuing his search, refused to return with him. Suffering from a clot in his artery, disoriented, bleeding internally, and hungry, he died in northeast Zambia in 1873. In his last moments, he had been kneeling in prayer. His heart, as he requested, was buried there, while the rest of his body was carried by his followers across the continent, borne aloft as if he were a saint, and transported back to England, where throngs of people paid tribute to him at Westminster Abbey. Fawcett later became friendly with the novelist who most vividly conjured up this world of the Victorian adventurer savant, Sir Henry Rider Haggard. In 1885, Haggard published King Solomon's Mines, which was advertised as the most amazing book ever written. Like many quest novels, it was patterned on folk tales and myths, such as that of the Holy Grail. The hero is the iconic Allan Quatermain, a no-nonsense elephant hunter who searches for a hidden cache of diamonds in Africa with a map traced in blood. V.S. Pritchett noted that, whereas E.M. Forster once spoke of the novelist sending down a bucket into the unconscious, Haggard installed a suction pump. He drained the whole reservoir of the public's secret desires. Yet Fawcett did not have to look so far to see his desires spilled on the page. After abandoning theosophy, Fawcett's older brother, Edward, remade himself into a popular adventure novelist who, for a time, was hailed as the English answer to Jules Verne. In 1894, he published Swallowed by an Earthquake, which tells the story of a group of friends who are plunged into a subterranean world where they discover dinosaurs and a tribe of wild man that eats men. It was Edward's next novel, however, that most acutely reflected his younger brother's private fantasies, and, in many ways, chillingly foretold Percy's future. Called The Secret of the Desert and published in 1895, the novel appeared with a blood-red cover that was engraved with a picture of an explorer wearing a pith helmet who was dangling from a rope over a palace wall. The tale centers on an amateur cartographer and archaeologist named Arthur Manners, the very personification of the Victorian sensibility. With funding from a scientific body, Manners, the most venturesome of travelers, abandons the quaint British countryside to explore the perilous region of Central Arabia. Insisting on going alone, possibly thinking that it would be just as well to enjoy what celebrity might be in store for him unshared, Manners wanders into the depths of the Great Red Desert in search of unknown tribes and archaeological ruins. After 2 years elapse without any word from him, many in England fear that he has starved or been taken hostage by a tribe. Three of Manners's colleagues launch a rescue mission, using an armor-plated vehicle that one of them has constructed, a futuristic contraption that, like Verne's submarine in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, reflects both the progress and the terrifying capabilities of European civilization. The expedition picks up reports that Manners headed in the direction of the fabled Oasis of Gazelles, which is said to contain strange ruins, relics of some race once no doubt of great renown, but now wholly forgotten. Anyone who has attempted to reach it has either vanished or been killed. As Manners' friends make toward it, they run out of water and fear that, We would-be rescuers are ourselves lost men. Then they spot a shimmering pool, the oasis of gazelles, and beside it are the ruins of a temple laden with treasure. I was overcome with admiration for the forgotten race that had reared this astounding fabric, the narrator says. The explorers discover that Manners is being held prisoner inside the temple and spirit him away in the high-speed tank. Without time to bring any artifacts to prove to the world their discovery, they must rely on Manners to persuade the skeptics. But a member of the expedition, planning to return and excavate the ruins before anyone else, says of Manners, "He won't, I hope, be very particular about mentioning the exact latitude and longitude." One day, Fawcett set out from Fort Frederick, trekking inland through a morass of vines and brambles. "Everywhere about me there was sound, the sound of the wild," he wrote of Ceylon's jungle. After hours, he came upon what he was looking for, a half-buried wall carved with hundreds of images of elephants. It was a remnant of an ancient temple, and all around it, Fawcett could see adjoining ruins, stone pillars and palace archways and dagobas. They were part of Anuradhapura, a city that had been built more than 2,000 years earlier. Now, as a contemporary of Fawcett's put it, the city has vanished like a dream. Where are the hands which reared it, the men who sought its shelter in the burning heat of noon? Later, Fawcett wrote a friend that the old Ceylon is buried under forest and mold. There are bricks and vanishing dagobas and inexplicable mounds, pits, and inscriptions. Fawcett was no longer a boy. He was in his 30s, and he could not bear to spend the rest of his life sequestered in one military garrison after another, entombed in his imagination. He wanted to become what Joseph Conrad had dubbed a geography militant, someone who, bearing in his breast a spark of the sacred fire, discovered along the secret latitudes and longitudes of the earth the mysteries of mankind. And he knew that there was only one place for him to go, the Royal Geographical Society in London. It had launched Livingstone and Speke and Burton and given birth to the Victorian Age of Discovery. And Fawcett had no doubt that it would help him realize what he called my destiny. Chapter 5. Blank Spots on the Map.
"Here you go, the Royal Geographical Society," the taxi driver said, as the cab let me out in front of the entrance across from Hyde Park on a February morning in 2005. The building resembled an extravagant manor, which it had been before the society, in need of a larger space, purchased it in 1912. 3 stories high, it had red brick walls, sash windows, Dutch pilasters, and an overhanging copper roof that came together, along with several chimneys, at various jumbled points, like a child's vision of a castle. Along the outer wall were life-size statues of Livingstone, with his trademark cap and walking stick, and of Ernest Shackleton, the Antarctic explorer, bundled in scarves and wearing boots. At the entrance, I asked a guard for the location of the archives, which I hoped would shed further light on Fawcett's career as an explorer and on his last voyage. When I had first called John Hemming, a former director of the Royal Geographical Society and a historian of the Brazilian Indians, to ask about the Amazon explorer, he said, "You're not one of those Fawcett lunatics, are you?" The society had apparently become wary of people who were consumed by Fawcett's fate. Despite the passage of time and the diminished likelihood of finding him, some people seemed to grow more rather than less fanatical. For decades, they had pestered the society for information, concocting their own bizarre theories before setting out into the wilderness to effectively commit suicide. They were often called the Fawcett freaks. One person who went in search of Fawcett in 1995 wrote in an unpublished article that his fascination had mutated into a virus and that, when he called upon the society for help, an exasperated staff person had said of Fawcett hunters, "I think they're mad. These people are completely obsessed." I felt slightly foolish descending upon the society to request all of Fawcett's papers, But the Society's archives, which contained Charles Darwin's sextant and Livingston's original maps, had been open to the general public only in the previous few months and could prove invaluable. A guard at the front desk gave me a card authorizing me to enter the building, and I walked down a cavernous marble corridor, passing an old smoking lounge and a walnut-paneled map room where explorers like Fawcett had once gathered. In recent years, the Society had added a modern glass pavilion, but the renovation could not dispel the anachronistic air that hung over the institution. Yet in Fawcett's day, the Society was helping to engineer one of the most incredible feats of humankind, the mapping of the world. Perhaps no deed, not the building of the Brooklyn Bridge or the Panama Canal, rivals its scope or human toll. The endeavor, from the time the ancient Greeks laid out the main principles of sophisticated cartography, took hundreds of years, cost millions of dollars, and claimed thousands of lives, and when it was all but over, the achievement was so overwhelming that few could recall what the world looked like before or how the feat had been accomplished. In a corridor of the Royal Geographical Society's building, I noticed on the wall a gigantic 17th-century map of the globe. On the margins were sea monsters and dragons. For ages, cartographers had no means of knowing what existed on most of the Earth, and more often than not, these gaps were filled in with fantastical kingdoms and beasts, as if the make-believe, no matter how terrifying, were less frightening than the truly unknown. During the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, maps depicted fowl in Asia that tore humans apart, a bird in Germany that glowed in the dark, people in India with everything from 16 toes to dog heads, and hyenas in Africa whose shadows rendered dogs mute, and a beast called a cockatrice that could kill with a mere puff of its breath. The most dreaded place on the map was the land of Gog and Magog, whose armies the book of Ezekiel had warned would one day descend from the north to wipe out the people of Israel, like a cloud to cover the land. At the same time, maps expressed the eternal longing for something more alluring, a terrestrial paradise. Cartographers included as central landmarks the Fountain of Youth, for which Ponce de Leon scoured Florida in the 16th century, and the Garden of Eden, which the 7th century encyclopedist Isidore of Seville reported as filled with every kind of wood and fruit-bearing tree, having also the tree of life. In the 12th century, these feverish visions were inflamed when a letter appeared in the court of the Emperor of Byzantium, purportedly written by a king named Prester John. It said, "I, Prester John, who reign supreme, exceed in riches, virtue, and power all creatures who dwell under heaven. 72 kings pay tribute to me." It continued, "Honey flows in our land, and milk everywhere abounds. In one of our territories, no poison can do harm, and no noisy frog croaks. No scorpions are there, and no serpents creep through the grass. No venomous reptiles can exist there or use their deadly power." Though the letter was likely written as an allegory, it was taken as proof of paradise on earth, which mapmakers placed in the unexplored territories of the Orient. In 1177, Pope Alexander III dispatched his personal physician to extend to the dearest son in Christ, the famous and high king of the Indians, the holy priest, his greetings and apostolic benediction. The doctor never returned. Still, the church and royal courts continued for centuries to send emissaries to locate this fabulous kingdom. In 1459, the learned Venetian cartographer Fra Mauro created one of the most exhaustive maps of the world. At last, Prester John's mythic kingdom was wiped from Asia. Instead, in Ethiopia, Mauro had written, "Qui il Prester Gianni fa residencial principal." Here Prester John makes his principal residence. Even as late as 1740, it was estimated that fewer than 120 places on the planet had been accurately mapped. Because precise portable clocks did not exist, navigators had no means of determining longitude, which is most easily measured as a function of time. Ships plowed into rocks and shoals, their captains convinced that they were hundreds of miles out to sea. Thousands of men and millions of dollars worth of cargo were squandered. In 1714, Parliament announced that the discovery of the longitude is of such consequence to Great Britain for the safety of the navy and merchant ships, as well as for the improvement of trade, that it was offering a £20,000 prize, the equivalent today of $12 million, for a practical and useful solution. Some of the greatest scientific minds tried to solve the problem. Most hoped to use the position of the moon and stars to fix time, but in 1773, John Harrison was recognized as the winner with his more feasible solution, a 3-pound diamond and ruby-laden chronometer. Despite its success, Harrison's clock could not overcome the main problem that had bedeviled mapmakers: distance. Europeans had not yet traveled to the farthest ends of the Earth, the North and South Poles. Nor had they surveyed much of the interior of Africa, Australia, or South America. Cartographers scrawled across these areas on the map a single haunting word: unexplored. Finally, in the 19th century, as the British Empire was increasingly expanding, several English scientists, admirals, and merchants believed that an institution was needed to create a map of the world based on observation rather than on imagination, an organization that detailed both the contours of the earth and everything that lay within them. And so, in 1830, the Royal Geographical Society of London was born. According to its mission statement, the Society would collect, digest, and print new interesting facts and discoveries, build a repository of the best books on geography and a complete collection of maps, assemble the most sophisticated surveying equipment, and help launch explorers on their travels. All this was part of its mandate to chart every nook and cranny of the Earth. There was not a square foot of the planet's surface to which fellows of this society should not at least try to go, a later president of the institution vowed. That is our business. That is what we are out for. While the society would serve as a handmaiden of the British Empire, what it was out for represented a departure from the previous age of discovery, when conquistadores, like Columbus, were dispatched strictly in pursuit of God, gold, and glory. In contrast, the Royal Geographical Society wanted to explore for the sake of exploration, in the name of the newest god, science. Within weeks of its unveiling, the society had attracted nearly 500 members. It was composed almost entirely of men of high social standing, a secretary of the institution later remarked, adding, "It may thus be regarded as having been to some extent a society institution to which everybody who was anybody was expected to belong." The original list of members included acclaimed geologists, hydrographers, natural philosophers, astronomers, and military officers, as well as dukes, earls, and knights. Darwin became a member in 1838, as did one of his sons, Leonard, who in 1908 was elected president of the society. As the society launched more and more expeditions around the world, it drew into its ranks not just adventurers, scholars, and dignitaries, but also eccentrics. The Industrial Revolution, in addition to producing appalling conditions for the lower classes, had engendered unprecedented wealth for members of the middle and upper classes in Britain, who could suddenly afford to make leisurely pursuits such as travel a full-time hobby. Hence the rise of the amateur in Victorian society. The Royal Geographical Society became a haven for such people, along with a few poorer members like Livingstone, whose exploits it helped to finance. Many of its members were awed even by Victorian standards. Richard Burton espoused atheism and defended polygamy so fervently that, while he was off exploring, his wife inserted into one of his manuscripts the following disclaimer: "I protest vehemently against his religious and moral sentiments, which belie a good and chivalrous life." Not surprisingly, such members produced a fractious body. Burton recalled how at a meeting attended by his wife and family, he grew so agitated after an opponent had spoken falsely that he waved his map pointer at members of the audience, who looked as if a tiger was going to spring in amongst them, or that I was going to use the stick like a spear upon my adversary, who stood up from the benches. To make the scene more lively, my wife's brothers and sisters were struggling in the corner to hold down their father, an old man, who had never been used to public speaking, and who slowly rose up in speechless indignation at hearing me accused of making a misstatement. Years later, another member conceded, "Explorers are not, perhaps, the most promising people with whom to build a society. Indeed, some might say that explorers become explorers precisely because they have a streak of unsociability and a need to remove themselves at regular intervals as far as possible from their fellow men." Debates raged within the society over the course of rivers and mountains, the boundaries of cities and towns, and the size of the oceans. No less intense were the disputes over who deserved recognition and the subsequent fame and fortune for making a discovery. And the discussions often involved the most fundamental questions of morality and human existence. Were newly discovered tribes savages or civilized? Should they be converted to Christianity? Did all of humanity stem from one ancient civilization or from many? The struggle to answer such questions frequently pitted the so-called armchair geographers and theoreticians who pored over incoming data against the rough-and-tumble explorers who worked in the field. One official of the society reprimanded an African explorer for his suppositions, telling him, "What you can do is state accurately what you saw, leaving it to stay-at-home men of science to collate the data of very many travelers in order to form a theory." The explorer speak, in turn, denounced those geographers who sit in carpet slippers and criticize those who labor in the field. Perhaps the most vicious feud was over the source of the Nile. After Speke claimed in 1858 that he had discovered the river's origin at a lake he christened Victoria, many of the society's members, led by his former traveling companion Burton, refused to believe him. Speke said of Burton, "B is one of those men who never can be wrong and will never acknowledge an error." In September of 1864, the two men, who had once nursed each other back from death on an expedition, were supposed to square off in a public meeting. The London Times called it a gladiatorial exhibition. But as the meeting was about to begin, the gatherers were informed that Speke would not be coming. He had gone hunting the previous day and was found dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. "By God, he's killed himself," Burton reportedly exclaimed, staggering on the stage. Later, Burton was seen in tears, reciting his one-time companion's name over and over. Although it was never known for certain if the shooting was intentional, many suspected, like Burton, that the protracted feud had caused the man who had conquered the desert to take his own life. A decade later, Speke's claim to having discovered the Nile's source would be proved correct. During the Society's early years, no member personified the organization's eccentricities or audacious mission more than Sir Francis Galton. A cousin of Charles Darwin's, he had been a child prodigy who, by the age of 4, could read and recite Latin. He went on to concoct myriad inventions. They included a ventilating top hat, a machine called a gumption reviver, which periodically wet his head to keep him awake during endless study, underwater goggles, and a rotating vane steam engine. Suffering from periodic nervous breakdowns, sprained brain, as he called it, he had a compulsion to measure and count virtually everything. He quantified the sensitivity of animal hearing using a walking stick that could make an inconspicuous whistle, the efficacy of prayer, the average age of death in each profession, lawyers 66.51, doctors 67.04, the exact amount of rope needed to break a criminal's neck while avoiding decapitation, and levels of boredom. At meetings of the Royal Geographical Society, he would count the rate of fidgets among each member of the audience. Notoriously, Galton, who, like so many of his colleagues, was a profound racist, tried to measure levels of intelligence in people and later became known as the father of eugenics. In another age, Galton's monomania with quantification might have made him a freak. But as the evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould once observed, no man expressed his era's fascination with numbers so well as Darwin's celebrated cousin. And there was no place that shared his fascination more than the Royal Geographical Society. In the 1850s, Galton, who had inherited enough money to enable him to avoid the burden of a conventional career, became a member of the society and, with its endorsement and guidance, explored southern Africa. "A passion for travel seized me," he wrote, "as if I had been a migratory bird." He mapped and documented everything that he could: latitudes and longitudes, topography, animals, climate, tribes. Returning to great fanfare, he received the Royal Geographical Society's gold medal, the field's most prestigious honor. In 1854, Galton was elected to the Society's governing body, on which, for the next four decades, he served in varying capacities, including honorary secretary and vice president. Together, Galton and this collection of men — they were all men until a divisive vote at the end of the 19th century admitted 21 women — began to attack, as Joseph Conrad put it, of such militant geographers, from north and south and east and west, conquering a bit of truth here and a bit of truth there, and sometimes swallowed up by the mystery their hearts were so persistently set on unveiling. "What materials are you looking for?" one of the archivists asked me. I had gone down into the small reading room in the basement. Bookshelves, illuminated under fluorescent lights, were crammed with travel guides, atlases, and bound copies of the Proceedings of the Royal Geographical Society. Most of the Society's collection of more than 2 million maps, artifacts, photographs, and expedition reports had been moved in recent years from what had been called Dickensian conditions to climate-controlled catacombs, and I could see staff flitting in and out of them through a side door. When I told the archivist that I was looking for Fawcett's papers, she gave me a quizzical look. "What is it?" I asked. "Well, let's just say many people who are interested in Fawcett are a little..." Her voice trailed off as she disappeared into the catacombs. While I was waiting, I skimmed through several accounts of expeditions backed by the Society. One described an 1844 expedition led by Charles Sturt and his second-in-command, James Poole, which searched the Australian desert for a legendary inland sea. "So great is the heat that our hair has ceased to grow. Our nails have become brittle as glass," Sturt wrote in his diary. "The scurvy shows itself upon us all. We are attacked by violent headaches, pains in the limbs, swollen and ulcerated gums. Mr. Poole became worse and worse. Ultimately, the skin over his muscles became black, and he lost the use of his lower extremities. On the 14th, he suddenly expired." The inland sea never existed, and these accounts made me aware of how much of the discovery of the world was based on failure rather than on success, on tactical errors and pipe dreams. The Society may have conquered the world, but not before the world had conquered its members. Among the Society's long list of those who were sacrificed, Fawcett filled a distinct category: neither alive nor dead, or, as one writer dubbed him, the living dead. The archivist soon emerged from the stacks, carrying a half-dozen mottled folders. As she placed them on the table, they released a purplish dust. "You'll have to put these on," she said, handing me a pair of white gloves. After I slipped them over my fingers, I opened the first folder. Yellowed, crumbling letters spilled out. On many of the pages were impossibly small, slanting words that ran together, as if written in code. It was Fawcett's handwriting. I took one of the pages and spread it in front of me. The letter was dated 1915 and began, "Dear Reeves." The name was familiar, and I opened one of the books on the Royal Geographical Society and scanned its index. Edward Ayerst Reeves had been the map curator of the institution from 1900 to 1933. The folders contained more than two decades of correspondence between Fawcett and officials at the Society. Many of the letters were addressed to Reeves or to Sir John Scott Kelty, who was the RGS secretary from 1892 to 1915, and later its vice president. There were also scores of letters from Nina, government officials, explorers, and friends concerning Fawcett's disappearance. I knew it would take me days, if not weeks, to go through everything, and yet I felt delight. Here was a roadmap to Fawcett's life,
as well as to his death. I held one of the letters up to the light. It was dated December 14, 1921. It said, "There is very little doubt that the forests cover traces of a lost civilization of a most unsuspected and surprising character." I opened my reporter's pad and started to take notes. One of the letters mentioned that Fawcett had received a diploma from the RGS. I had never seen any reference to the society having given out diplomas, and I asked the archivist why Fawcett had been awarded one. "He must have been enrolled in one of the society's training programs," she said. She walked over to a bookshelf and began to riffle through journals. "Yes, right here. He apparently took a course and graduated around 1901. "You mean he actually went to school to become an explorer?" "I guess you could call it that." Chapter 6. The Disciple. Fawcett didn't want to be late. It was February 4, 1900, and all he had to do was get from his hotel in Redhill, Surrey, to number 1 Savile Row in the Mayfair district of London. But nothing in the city moved, or more accurately, everything seemed to be moving. Billboard men, butcher boys, clerks, horse-drawn omnibuses, and that strange beast which was invading the streets, scaring the horses and pedestrians, breaking down on every curb. The automobile. The law had originally required drivers to proceed at no more than 2 miles per hour, with a footman walking ahead waving a red flag. But in 1896, the speed limit had been raised to 14 miles per hour. And everywhere Fawcett turned, the new and the old seemed to be at war. Electric lights scattered on the fancier granite streets, and gas lamps lodged on most cobblestoned corners, glowing in the fog. The tube bolting through the earth like one of Edward Fawcett's science fiction inventions, and bicycles, only a few years earlier the smartest thing on the footpaths, and now already fusty. Even the smells seemed at odds. The traditional stench of horse dung and the newer whiff of petrol. It was as if Fawcett were glimpsing the past and the future at once. Since he had left England for Ceylon 14 years earlier, London seemed to have become more crowded, more dirty, more modern, more rich, more poor, more everything. With over 4.5 million people, London was the biggest city in the world, larger than Paris or New York. Flower girls yelled, "All a-growin' and all a-blowin'!" Newspaper boys cried, "Horrible murder!" As Fawcett pushed his way through the crowds, he no doubt struggled to keep his clothes free of the soot from coal furnaces that had mixed with fog to form London's own species of grime, a tenacious black mixture that penetrated everything. Even the keyholes on houses had to be sheathed with metal plates. Then there was the horse manure, the London mud, as it was politely called, which, though swept up by street urchins and sold door to door as garden fertilizer, was virtually everywhere Fawcett stepped. Fawcett turned onto an elegant street in Burlington Gardens, away from brothels and blacking factories. On the corner was a handsome stone house with a portico. It was number 1 Savile Row, and Fawcett could see the bold sign, Royal Geographical Society. As Fawcett entered the 3-story house, the society had not yet moved near to Hyde Park, he was aware that he was stepping into an enchanting place. Over the front door was a half window in the shape of a hemispherical lantern. Each pane represented the parallels and meridians of a globe. Fawcett would have walked past the office of the chief clerk and his 2 assistants, past a stairwell that led to a council room, until he arrived at a glass-roofed chamber. Sunlight filtered in, illuminating, through dusty shafts, globes and chart tables. It was the map room, and usually sitting at the far end, on a dais, was the man Fawcett was looking for, Edward Ayerst Reeves. In his late 30s, with a receding hairline, beakish nose, and neatly trimmed mustache, Reeves was not only the map curator, but also the chief instructor of surveying, and the person primarily charged with turning Fawcett into a gentleman explorer. A skilled draftsman, Reeves had started working at the society in 1878,
at the age of 16, as an assistant to the previous curator, and he never seemed to forget that sense of awe that newcomers felt upon arrival. "How well I remember it all," he wrote in his autobiography, The Recollections of a Geographer. "With what pride, and yet with what fear and trembling, I first entered the precinct of this wonderful place of which I had read in books, and from which explorers had been sent out to all parts of the world and returned to tell of their marvelous discovery and heroic adventures." Unlike many of the bellicose, wild-eyed members of the society, Reeves had a warm, gentle manner. "He had an innate capacity for teaching," a colleague said. "He knew exactly how to put a point so that the most obtuse student could grasp it." Fawcett and Reeves eventually went up to the third floor, where the classes were held. Francis Galton had advised each recruit that he would soon find himself admitted into the society of men with whose names he had long been familiar and whom he had reverenced as his heroes. Taking the surveying course about the same time as Fawcett was Charles Lindsay Temple, who could regale his colleagues with stories of his time in the civil service in Brazil. Lieutenant T. Danreuther, who was obsessed with collecting rare butterflies and insects, and Arthur Edward Seymour Lawton, who was gunned down by Mexican bandits in 1913 at the age of 38. Reeves got down to business. If Fawcett and the other students heeded his instructions, they could become the next generation of great explorers. Reeves would teach them what cartographers had not been able to do for most of history: fix their position anywhere. If you could blindfold a man and take him to any spot on the Earth's surface, say somewhere in the middle of Africa, and then remove the bandage from his eyes, he could, if properly trained, show you on a map in a short time the exact spot upon which he stands, Reeves said. Moreover, if Fawcett and his colleagues dared to climb the highest peaks and penetrate the deepest forest, they could chart the world's remaining undiscovered realms. Reeves displayed a series of strange objects. One looked like a telescope attached to a circular metal wheel with various screws and chambers. Reeves explained that it was a theodolite, which could determine the angle between the horizon and celestial bodies. He demonstrated more tools: artificial horizons, aneroids, and sextants, and then led Fawcett and the others up to the roof of the building to test the equipment. The fog often made it hard to observe the sun or the stars, but now they could see well enough. "Latitude," Reeves said, "could be found by measuring the angle of the noon sun above the horizon, or the height of the North Star," and each of the students tried to use the devices to fix his position, an extremely difficult task for a beginner. As Fawcett took his turn, Reeves watched in astonishment. "He was extremely quick at learning anything new," Reeves recalled. "And although he never used a sextant and artificial horizon before for star observation, I remember the first night he tried, he brought the stars down into the artificial horizon and took excellent altitude right away without any difficulty. Anyone who has attempted this will know that as a rule, it is only done after considerable practice." Fawcett was taught not just how to survey, but how to see, to record and classify everything around him in what the Greeks called an autopsis. There were two principal manuals to help him. One was Art of Travel, written by Francis Galton for a general audience. The other was Hints to Travelers, which had been edited by Galton and served as the Society's unofficial Bible. Fawcett brought a copy with him even on his final trip. The 1893 edition stated, "It is a loss both to himself and others when a traveler does not observe." The manual continued, "Remember that the first and best instruments are the traveler's own eyes. Use them constantly and record your observation on the spot, keeping for the purpose a notebook with numbered pages and a map. Put down as they occur all important objects: streams, their volume, color; mountain ranges, their character and apparent structure and glaciation; the color and forms of the landscape; prevalent winds, climate. In short, describe to yourself at the time all you see." The need to record every observation was so ingrained that during Robert Falcon Scott's race to the South Pole, he continued to make notations even as he and all his men were dying. Among the last words scribbled in his diary were, "Had we lived, I should have had a tale to tell of the hardihood, endurance, and courage of my companions, which would have stirred the heart of every Englishman. These rough notes, and our dead bodies, must tell the tale." To hone the aspiring explorer's powers of observation, the manuals, in conjunction with seminars provided by the Society, offered basic instructions on botany, geology, and meteorology. Students were also initiated into the fledgling field of anthropology, what was then often called the science of savages. Despite the Victorians' dizzying contact with alien cultures, the field was still composed almost entirely of amateurs and enthusiasts. In 1896, Great Britain had only one university professor of anthropology. Just as Fawcett had been taught to see the contours of the earth, he was now taught how to observe the other, what hints to travelers referred to as savages, barbarians, or the lower civilized nations. The manual warned each student against the prejudices with which his European mode of thought has been surrounded, even as it noted that it is established that some races are inferior to others in volume and complexity of brain, Australians and Africans being in this respect below Europeans. As with mapping the world, there were tools for taking the measure of man, tape lines and calipers for calculating body proportions, dynamometers for assessing muscle strength and spring balances to determine weight, plaster of Paris for making impressions, and a craniometer to gauge the size of a skull. Where practicable, native skeletons, and especially skulls, should be sent home for accurate examination, the manual said. Of course, this could be tricky. It is hardly safe to risk the displeasure of the natives at the removal of the dead. It was deemed unknown how emotions are differently expressed by different races, so that it is worthwhile to notice particularly if they're smiling, laughing, frowning, weeping, blushing, etc., differ perceptibly from ours. Fawcett and his classmates were also schooled in the fundamentals of mounting and executing an expedition, everything from how to make pillows out of mud to choosing the best pack animals. Notwithstanding his inveterate obstinacy, the ass is an excellent and sober little beast, far too much despised by us, Galton pointed out, calculating, with his usual obsessiveness, that an ass could carry about 65 pounds, a horse up to 100 pounds, and a camel up to 300. Before embarking, the explorer was instructed to have each member of his expedition sign a formal agreement, like a treaty. Galton provided a sample. "We, the undersigned, forming an expedition about to explore the interior of blank, under Mr. A, consent to place ourselves, horses and equipments, entirely and unreservedly under his orders for the above purpose, from the date hereof until our return to blank, or, on failure in this respect, to abide all consequences that may result. We severally undertake to use our best endeavors to promote the harmony of the party and the success of the expedition. In witness whereof, we sign our names." Here follow the signatures. The students were warned that they should not lord it over their men and must constantly be on the lookout for cliques, dissent, and mutiny. "Promote merriment, singing, fiddling, with all your powers," Galton advised. Care must also be taken with native helpers. A frank, joking, but determined manner, joined with an air of showing more confidence to the savage than you really feel, is the best. Disease and injury could devastate a party, and Fawcett received some basic medical tips. He learned, for instance, how to remove a decaying tooth by constantly pushing and pulling. If he ingested poison, he was taught to immediately make himself throw up. Use soap suds or gunpowder if proper emetics are not at hand. For a venomous snake bite, Fawcett would have to ignite gunpowder in the wound or cut away the infected flesh with a knife. Afterwards, burn out the area around the bite with the end of your iron ramrod. Heat it as near a white heat as you can readily get, Galton advised. The arteries lie deep, and as much flesh may, without much danger, be cut or burnt into as the fingers can pinch up.
The next step is to use the utmost energy and even cruelty to prevent the patient's giving way to that lethargy and drowsiness which is the usual effect to snake poison and too often ends in death. The treatment for a hemorrhaging wound, say from an arrow, was equally barbarous. Pour boiling grease into the wound. Nothing, though, compared with the horrors of thirst and hunger. One trick was to excite saliva in the mouth. This can be done by chewing something, as a leaf, or by keeping in the mouth a bullet or a smooth, non-absorbent stone, such as a quartz pebble, Galton explained. When starving, Fawcett was instructed to drink an animal's blood, if available. Locusts, grasshoppers, and other insects were also edible, and might save a man's life. To prepare them, pull off the legs and wings and roast them with a little grease in an iron dish, like coffee. Then there was the threat of hostile savages and cannibals. When penetrating such territories, an explorer was cautioned to move under the cover of darkness with a rifle cocked and ready. To seize a prisoner, take your knife, put it between your teeth, and, standing over him, take the caps off your gun and lay it down by your side. Then handcuff him in whatever way you best can. The reason of setting to work in this way is that a quick, supple savage, while you are fumbling with your strings and bothered with a loaded gun, might easily spring round, seize hold of it, and quite turn the tables against you. Finally, the students were advised how to proceed if a member of their party perished. They must write down a detailed account of what had happened and have the remaining members of the expedition corroborate it. If a man be lost, before you turn away and abandon him to his fate, call the party formally together and ask them if they are satisfied that you have done all that was possible to save him and record their answers, Galton stated. When a companion died, his effects must be collected for relatives and his body buried with dignity. Choose a well-marked situation, dig a deep grave, bush it with thorns, and weight it well over with heavy stones as a defense against animals of prey. After more than a year of coursework, Fawcett sat down, along with his classmates, for the final examination. The students had to demonstrate a mastery of surveying, which required a deep understanding of complex geometry and astronomy. Fawcett had spent hours cramming with Nina, who shared his interest in exploration and worked tirelessly to help him. If he failed, he knew that he would be back to square one, back to being a soldier. He carefully filled in each answer. When he finished, he handed his paper in to Reeves. Then he waited. Reeves informed the students of their results and broke the news to Fawcett. He had passed, and more than that. Reeves, in his memoir, singled Fawcett out, noting that he had graduated with great credit. Fawcett had done it. He had received the imprimatur of the Royal Geographical Society, or, as he put it, "The RGS bred me as an explorer." All he needed now was a mission. Chapter 7. Freeze-dried ice cream and adrenaline socks. "You can't just go like that," my wife said. I looked down at the bed where I had laid out some shorts and a pair of Adidas sneakers. "I've got a Swiss Army knife," I said. "You're not giving me a whole lot of confidence." The next day, at her prodding, I tried to find a place where I could purchase more suitable gear. Friends directed me to one of the many stores in Manhattan that catered to the growing numbers of hikers, off-road bikers, extreme sports junkies, and weekend warriors. The store was virtually the size of an industrial warehouse, and as I stepped inside, I was overwhelmed. There were rainbow-colored tents and banana-hued kayaks and mauve mountain bikes and neon snowboards dangling from the ceilings and walls. Whole aisles were devoted to insect repellents, freeze-dried foods, lip balms, and sunscreens. A separate section existed for footwear. "Gurus can lead you to a perfect fit," a sign said, which didn't include an additional space for spring-loaded ratchet-binding snowshoes. There was an area for adrenaline socks and one for Tech-Wick skivvies. Racks held magazines like Hooked on the Outdoors and Backpacker, The Outdoors at Your Doorstep,
which had articles titled Survive a Bear Attack and America's Last Wild Places, 31 Ways to Find Solitude, Adventure, and Yourself. Wherever I turned, there were customers or gearheads. It was as if the fewer the opportunities for genuine exploration, the greater the means were for anyone to attempt it, and the more baroque the ways, bungee cording, snowboarding, that people found to replicate the sensation. Exploration, however, no longer seemed aimed at some outward discovery. Rather, it was directed inward, to what guidebooks and brochures called camping and wilderness therapy and personal growth through adventure. I was standing in bewilderment before a glass case filled with several watch-like contraptions when a young attendant with long, lean arms appeared from behind the counter. He had the glow of someone who had recently returned from Mount Everest. "Can I help you with something?" he asked. "What's that thing there?" I asked. "Oh, that rocks." He slid open the counter door and removed the item. "It's a little computer, see? It'll give you the temperature wherever you are, and the altitude. It's also got a digital compass, clock, alarm, and chronometer. You can't beat it." I asked how much it was, and he said about $200, though I wouldn't regret it. "And what's that?" I asked, pointing to another gadget. "Pretty much the same deal, only that one monitors your heart rate, too. Plus, it's a great logbook. It'll store all the data you want to put in about weather, distances, rates of ascent, you name it. What kind of trip you planning anyway?" When I explained, as best I could, my intentions, he seemed enthusiastic, and I thought of one faucet seeker from the 1930s who had classified people based on their reactions to his plans. There were the prudent, who said, "This is an extraordinarily foolish thing to do." There were the wise, who said, "This is an extraordinarily foolish thing to do, but at least you will know better next time." There were the very wise, who said, "This is a foolish thing to do, but not nearly so foolish as it sounds." There were the romantic, who appeared to believe that if everyone did this sort of thing all the time, the world's troubles would soon be over. There were the envious, who thanked God they were not coming. And there were the other sort, who said with varying degrees of insincerity that they would give anything to come. There were the correct, who asked me if I knew any of the people at the embassy. There were the practical, who spoke at length of inoculations and calibers. There were the apprehensive, who asked me if I had made my will. There were the men who had done a certain amount of that sort of thing in their time, you know, and these imparted to me elaborate stratagems for getting the better of ants, and told me that monkeys made excellent eating, and so for that matter did lizards, and parrots. They all tasted rather like chicken. The salesman seemed like the romantic type. He asked how long I intended to go, and I said I didn't know. At least a month, probably more. "Awesome. Awesome. That should let you get immersed in the place." He seemed to be thinking of something. Then he asked if it was true that some catfish in the Amazon, called a candiru, you know, that it... He didn't finish his question, though he didn't have to. I had read about the almost translucent, toothpick-like creature in Exploration Fawcett. More feared than piranhas, it is one of the few creatures in the world to survive strictly on a diet of blood. It is also called the vampire fish of Brazil. Ordinarily, it burrows in the gills of a fish and sucks its blood, but it also strikes human orifices, a vagina or an anus. It is perhaps most notorious for lodging in a man's penis, where it latches on irrevocably with its spines. Unless removed, it means death, and in the remote Amazon, victims are reported to have been castrated in order to save them. Fawcett, who had seen a candiru that had been surgically extricated from a man's urethra, said, "Many deaths result from this fish, and the agony it can cause is excruciating." When I told the salesman what I knew about the candiru, he seemed to transform from the romantic into the practical. Although there was little to protect someone from such a creature, he told me about one gizmo after another that was revolutionizing the art of camping. A tool that was a digital thermometer, a flashlight, a magnifying glass, and a whistle. Compression sacks that shrank everything inside. Swiss Army knives with a computer flash drive to store photographs and music, water purifying bottles that doubled as lanterns, portable solar-powered hot showers, kayaks that folded into the size of a duffel bag, a floating flashlight that didn't need batteries, parkas that converted into sleeping bags, pole-less tents, a tablet that destroys viruses and bacteria in 15 minutes. The more he explained things, the more emboldened I became. I can do this, I thought, piling several of the most James Bond-like items into my basket. Finally, the salesman said, "You've never camped before, have you?" He then helped me